This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. George Carlin is the comic who said the 7 dirty words you can't say on TV. He didn't say them on TV, but when he said them in a 1972 performance, he was arrested. And when radio station WBAI played his recording of the monologue, it led to a major FCC decision which upheld restricting indecent language on the radio. George Carlin was one of the most popular counterculture comics of the early 70s. He was irreverent. He attacked establishment values. His observational humor was often from the perspective of being high. Carlin has since become a popular guest on The Tonight Show, recorded many albums, branched out into movies, and had his own cable specials. His new one premieres Saturday, June 2nd on HBO. Carlin says that while some people object to the language he uses, what he objects to is the sanitized euphemisms that have entered our language, euphemisms that only obscure meaning.
Some of these are small examples that, taken as a larger body, make the point a little bit better, because these are trivial things. But there is an example of something that happened in this century to a certain condition, a combat condition, when people can't handle any more combat. In the First World War, back over 70 years ago, that was called shell shock, which is very descriptive, very simple, honest, and direct language. Shell shock. It describes exactly what it is. It almost sounds like guns. In the Second World War, a generation later, they decided to call that battle fatigue. It's twice as long now, four syllables, takes longer to say, doesn't seem to hurt. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock, battle fatigue. Then we had Korea, 1950, they called the same thing operational exhaustion. Now the humanity is completely missing from it, and it sounds like something that might happen to your Jeep. And in Vietnam, of course, thanks to the deception surrounding that war, the same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. And my point is, if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, maybe Vietnam veterans might have gotten some attention at the time, because the language would have described what was wrong with them instead of describing some psychologist's ideal phrase for taking up space.
One of the things you're very famous for is the 7 dirty words case. And
right.
This is you had a routine about 7 dirty words you can't say on television.
Right.
In 1972, you were arrested for doing this on stage.
Yeah.
And in just a few years later, a radio station in New York, a listener-supported station,
right,
played the routine from the record, and that became a kind of classic obscenity case.
It went to the Supreme Court, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was a very important case that everybody
footnote
in radio knows about.
I'm a legal footnote.
And, of course, you lost.
I wasn't really an active participant.
Right, I don't mean you personally,
but the radio station
lost.
They did indeed.
Yeah.
The FCC was upheld.
Now, part of what this routine was about was the absurdity of banning words,
yes,
the absurdity of being so offended
by
language.
One would think that would be protected speech.
And an example you gave was, and I can't give the full thing, but you said you can say, don't prick your finger, but if you reverse the order of those words, that would be considered obscene.
Right.
Did the judges in the various trials get the point, do you think?
Absolutely not. I don't think they even listened. I'm sure they didn't listen to the record to hear it in its fullest and best context. I'm sure they read portions of the transcript. It's in the interest, I guess, of the white male, religious, corporate, paramilitary state that we live in to control us. And the FCC, of course, has control only over broadcast media. And I guess they found a way to interpret that form of expression differently from the printed word and the spoken word. The argument, which I think is specious, is that because this goes out into the home, that somehow it's going to injure someone morally if it comes through the speaker. They don't take into account the fact that there is an on-off switch on every radio and there is a station selector knob for changing the station. The man who made the complaint, one of these moral commandos, a professional moralist who wants us to live his way, sat in his car with his son and listened to the entire broadcast, and I assume they were not morally degraded in any way. I assume the child has developed in a normal way in spite of listening to that routine. So where is the argument? I don't follow the damage. I don't see where the damage occurs in this language being used.
You know, Lenny Bruce always said that when he was up on obscenity charges,
yeah,
that he wished he could perform the material for the judges, you
yeah
know, because they were hearing, you know, either reading transcriptions or they were hearing people quote the material.
A cop was doing his act.
Right, that's it. Yeah. And, you know, Bruce really felt, well, if they're going to get what it's about, they have to hear me do it. Did you feel that way yourself?
Well, I feel that the thing was rigged to start with, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think the outcome was inevitable. But surely it would have been fairer to the process to listen to the recording. And the other thing about it is there was a warning given, there was a disclaimer given by the radio station saying that there'll be language on this next recording which you may find offensive. There was the point made that it was in the context of speaking about protected speech. And certainly there, in that case, that has to be a redeeming artistic feature, which is one of the tests for obscenity. Of course, they didn't test it for obscenity. They called it indecency and got around the obscenity law in that manner.
Now, you were arrested in Milwaukee in 1972.
Yeah, now that was more for public, what you call it, disorderly conduct. The concert was outdoors, and the speakers, the concert setting outdoors was in a larger setting of a festival, a summer fest.
Mm-hmm.
And so the complaint was made on the basis of the fact that the language coming from these speakers flowed out of the concert area into the area of the general public. And the policeman felt that was wrong. I think his idea was, he said, there were mothers listening to this, which I don't understand at all. But at any rate, we just waited, as the lawyer told me. He said, we're going to wait a few months on this case until a judge comes around who understands the First Amendment. And apparently in Milwaukee, that took about 6 months.
Did you expect to be arrested? Did you have any idea this was coming?
Oh, absolutely not. No, and I think it was a spur-of-the-moment decision on the part of one policeman.
And how did they come get you?
Oh, they just came backstage. My wife came out on stage during the show to warn me that they were back there. She came out ostensibly to bring me a glass of water, and it was a large kind of unruly audience and everything, so an interruption like that wasn't particularly damaging to the flow of the show or anything. So she just got me aside and said, there's police backstage and they're going to arrest you. So I went off stage a different way where they weren't waiting. And at that time, I was still a user of illegal substances. And so I got rid of what I had on me so that the only arrest would be for this spoken violation and not for something else, which they would have loved to catch me doing.
George Carlin is my guest, and he has a new HBO special that premieres on Saturday, June 2nd. How did you start using, quote, dirty words in your performances?
Well, I always felt that I didn't want to be denied a significant portion of the language, significant not numerically, but in terms of impact in speech. You know, I just felt that if I was forever going to avoid these words, that I was somewhat crippling my ability to express myself. I use those words in my private life. People I know do. They're valuable words for expression. They give spice and emphasis to language, and they, in the sense of comedy monologues, they can be very useful in giving characters, enhancing characterizations and giving emphasis to ideas. So I didn't want to be crippled by not having them available to me. See, like, my point is, a person like Bill Cosby is forever forbidden now to use those words publicly because people don't expect it of him. I wanted to have the choice. I think you're freer when you have a choice. I think to not use them would have made me a form of restricted speaker, and I didn't want that. So I just decided to use them so they'd always be available to me.
But there weren't many comics using those words when you started.
No. Of course, you mentioned Lenny Bruce, who opened the door for that kind of language, but he didn't, so to speak, get away with it. They hunted him down and killed him, the Catholic Church and the police. So he was the one who opened the doors and paid for it. People like Richard Pryor and I and others who've come, Cheech and Chong and others who came afterward, were able to benefit from what happened to him and to be successful in spite of the language, not because of it.
So when you go on TV and you have to clean up your monologues, do you use different parts or do you just take out the forbidden words?
No, I do things that don't require those words. I have, you know, I have the ability to find things in life that are humorous, that are gentle, and somewhat innocent, and which can be expressed without using forceful or street language. So I use those things because I'm not on television to change their system. I'm there usually to promote myself. I do a trade-off with television. I use them and they use me, and I get what I want out of it, which is to mention some project I'm involved in. So I'm not there to change the system. I'm there to fit in for those few minutes, and I try to do that by using other humor that doesn't require this kind of forceful expression.
What kind of language did you grow up with? You've called yourself a street corner comic when you were growing up.
Right.
So what kind of language did you use then?
Well, we were a tough neighborhood, so you can imagine.
Where was this?
123rd in Amsterdam in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
We called it White Harlem because that sounded tougher than Morningside Heights, which is what Columbia University wanted to call it. And we grew up there, very close to that institutional neighborhood, Teachers College, Barnard, Columbia, St. John the Divine, Grant's Tomb, Riverside Church, Juilliard School of Music, Union Theological Seminary, and Jewish Theological Seminary on one side of us, and on the other side, a Puerto Rican and Cuban section and Black Harlem. So we had this little Irish enclave, and to be tough to other guys, we called ourselves guys from White Harlem.
So what did it mean to be a street corner comic? I mean, what do you mean
well,
when you say
I
that?
Well, all I meant is that I was one of the funny guys. There were a lot of kids in my neighborhood that were funny. The Irish have a vocal gift, many of them, a gift of speech and storytelling and being colorful speakers. And so it was a lively scene on the street corner or on the stoops, the verbal jousting and the insults, the dozens, the black street game, the dozens, which involves insulting each other's mothers and close relatives. All this stuff went on, and you had to be kind of quick to survive. Well, beyond that kind of repartee, which is maybe a high-toned word for something a little more common in nature, I also did routines. I could imitate people and do voices and characters, and so I would make up these stories and routines and I was kind of the comic in the crowd, and they'd pay attention to me, and I'd talk for 10 or so minutes, and then the next time I'd see them, they'd say, George, you do that thing again, about what? And I'd forget what it was. So I was a kind of a guerrilla entertainer on the street corner.
You were one of the first comics to do observational humor about being high.
Hmm.
You eventually developed a coke habit, which you kicked a few years ago. I'm wondering how you think it changed your monologues when you gave up those drugs.
Well, because it changed most everything else about my life. By the way, I gave up my drugs one at a time. I wasn't one of these people who went somewhere and came back different.
Uh-huh.
I had to evolve because these things that I had used, pot, beer, tobacco, and cocaine, had taken a long time to become part of my life, and so it took a while to get over them. And I dropped them one at a time. And the way I dropped them was by noticing, one by one, noticing that they were more trouble than pleasure. And so my common sense told me, this is stupid, George. This isn't why. You're supposed to be doing these things to feel better, not to feel worse. So they went away one at a time.
Do you think that your subject matter has changed, since a lot of your subject matter used to be about drugs?
Well, if I may correct you politely, people have that impression, and it's not as true, I think, as they see it. There was some. I obviously referred to them strongly when I did a bit about them, but compared to the number of bits I did, the percentage was really not much more than you'd expect at that time when
mm-hmm.
drugs were more glorified and more in the foreground. So it's true there was more of it then in my act, but the percentage wasn't so high. But the focus lately has been more toward political and social commentary on, you know, the culture and stuff, because that's what's emerged next for me. A lot of these things come and go. For several years, I'm interested in dogs and what's in the refrigerator and how we tie our shoes and how we drive and a place for your stuff. And then suddenly I find myself paying attention to other things. I don't drive this bus. I ride on it. And I look out the window, and suddenly I'm seeing things that are different from 5 years ago. So I'm happy now that I'm getting to vent some of this frustration and anger at what I really see as a declining second-rate culture. Sorry.
Hey, I don't take it personally.
No, I know. I was sort of saying it to the culture.
Oh. Did drugs ever help you on stage?
I don't think so. I think, you see, I'll never know because I can't know both things.
Right.
But I would have to say that the only thing they ever helped with was endurance. I used to do these 2.5-hour shows, and a certain, you know, the result of speed drugs, a certain kind of relentlessness. But as far as thinking was concerned, I mean, these things alter the function of the brain. They alter the electrochemical functions of the brain, and that doesn't help, especially in quantities, using them in quantities that are completely out of line.
Now, you had a club career before you... before you became...
I started in nightclubs.
Yeah, but, I mean, you started in nightclubs before you became known as a counterculture, radical type comic.
But let's go back to step A, because nightclubs were step B and countercultural was step C. In step A, I was a folk room coffee house comic who did have an edge. I did have an edge in my material. There was a degree of irreverence because those audiences and those places were places of irreverence. It was the end of the beatnik era, prior to what became the hippies. And there has always been that subculture. Bohemians was the name for it once. There'll always be that rebellious group that is swimming against the tide. And I identified with them from my childhood. So I was from that wellspring, and I became this kind of safe nightclub comedian with a tie because I felt that's what I had to do to have an acting career. I wanted to be like Danny Kaye and Red Skelton. My boyhood dream was to be a comic actor in movies, and I saw comedy as a stepping stone. I didn't know that I'd be as good at it as I think I am, nor that it would last as long as it has. So I... saw it as a stepping stone, and that period of, let's say, 1965 through 1970 was a period of trying to play the game as I saw the game in order to get somewhere, which is a mistake, but that's what life is for, I think, having a chance to make these mistakes and correct them. So when I became, as it were, you know, this new figure, this different guy, which, by the way, happened slowly. I didn't go away to the mountain and come back different. I grew my beard in public, and I let my hair grow, and my material changed slowly. But when that change came, it was back to something I was originally in a more intense form, no question. And by that time, there was a very large counterculture. The bohemian beatnik sort of underground had become part of the above ground. And so there was an audience out there that was ready and willing for me to meet, and that was what was terrific about that period for me.
Well, during those safe years when you were trying to play the game and make it with a suit and tie and everything, what kind of humor were you doing?
Well, it was kind of superficial stuff. I think it was funny. There was some, as I listen to it now, the bomb thrower in me was even active then, because there are these little swipes at straight society that were taking place. Even Al Sleet, the hippy-dippy weatherman, who was this, who was a part of that mainstream period I was in, Al Sleet was clearly a pothead and a guy who was, not one of them. So it's funny how I was even infiltrating my own comedy with these people and these ideas. But I was doing mostly media-oriented parody. I did stuff about newscasts, disc jockeys, weathermen, commercials, soap operas, all things based on television and radio, and mostly parody, and for the most part, kind of superficial stuff.
Well, you had gotten your start on radio.
Yeah, I was a DJ. That was part of my boyhood plan. I'll become a disc jockey, and if I'm good enough at that, they'll have to let me be a comedian, and if I'm good enough at that, they'll have to let me become an actor. That was kind of my 10-year-old, when I was 10 or 11, my plan. And it worked pretty much the way I had hoped. The comedy period lasted much longer, and I'm entering the acting phase later than I expected, but that's beginning to have some real substance to it.
George Carlin is my guest. He has an HBO special that premieres Saturday, June 2nd. You went to Catholic school.
Yeah, I went to a rather progressive Catholic parochial school, which was very much different from the kind of horror stories we hear about Catholic schools, especially in that era. I went to a school where the nuns were specially trained. They had special master's degrees from Catholic University. We were taught religion, but we didn't have uniforms. We didn't have the sexes in different classrooms. There was no corporal punishment. It was very progressive. Certainly for the 1940s, it was progressive, because what it amounted to is that the Catholic Church was actually experimenting with humane treatment. And by the way, my third grade teacher, Sister Marie Richard, will be at my show in Davenport, Iowa this Sunday. I've been in touch with her over recent years. She's now called Melita Conlon, and she wears street clothes, but she's still part of the Dominican Teaching Order. And she encourages me. She says, I know that what you do is sort of in service of a larger objective. And she has given me, if I needed it, which maybe I did, a kind of imprimatur from my former Catholic teachers, that that what I'm doing is okay.
So you're not going to worry about embarrassing her?
No, she's been to the shows before, and I always warn her. And I told her this time, I said, Sister, it's a little rougher than it was 2 years ago. She said, you're getting rougher? And I said, yes. But there are a few things that when I think they're just like too harsh, I'll take them out when I do the show. She'll have a lot of priests and people with her. And I don't like making people uncomfortable. I don't think I have an obligation to force what I think is correct or okay into other people's lives. With Sister Conlon, it's okay, but if she's going to have guests with her, I'll probably try to protect them. You know, I don't really want to injure someone.
George Carlin. His new HBO special, George Carlin Doing It Again, will be shown on various dates during the first 2 weeks of June. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.